Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the real heroines in that war these days is Pamela Geller. You probably know her best for the work that she has done in calling attention to, warning about, and otherwise helping arouse Americans to the danger posed by what I think of as Sharia supremacism. She is the founder, the editor, and publisher of The Geller Report. You can find it at gellerreport.com. She is also the president of the American Freedom Defense Initiative and an organization called Stop Islamization of America. She has just published, in a most timely way, a brand new and very, very relevant book, Fatwa, Hunted in America. It is one of several of her bestsellers, this one on its way to becoming one, I'm quite certain, and couldn't be more timely in particular because of the attack this week in her native New York City. Pamela Geller, it's so great to catch up with you. Congratulations on your new book and on all of the work that you do. We're delighted to be able to showcase it a little bit here today.
Hey, thank you, Frank, for having me.
So just for the uninitiated, what is a fatwa and how does that bear on the challenges that you in particular, among others, are now facing?
Well, it's a good question. It's part of the reason why I named the book Fatwa, because it is a legal ruling by a recognized authority under Islam. And in this case, it's a death sentence. And they're very real. I mean, there have been a number of assassination attempts. Most are familiar with the Garland, Texas free speech event, which was attacked by two jihadis, but thankfully were taken out by my security team, my SWAT team. But just last week, in Boston, the ringleader of an Islamic plot to behead me was convicted on all charges and now faces a life sentence. So this is an ongoing thing. Fatwas have no expiration date. If you recall the Charlie Hebdo Paris Weekly, whose editorial staff was targeted and assassinated in cold blood because of a perceived insult to Islam. They had run a cartoon of Muhammad. Now, that fatwa was issued 2 years prior. And of course, everyone knows Salman Rushdie's fatwa, which was issued in 1989. And that's still very much in play.
The further point is that it is incumbent upon anyone who embraces this Sharia program to execute this kind of fatwa, is it not? It's not just a specific authorization for one particular individual to do it.
Oh, no. As a matter of fact, if you look at how the fatwas have been, executed, no pun intended, they're usually natives, in my case, American Muslims or the French Muslims. No, it's not geography. It's certainly not nationality. It's purely ideology.
And it's unfortunately symptomatic, isn't it, of what is really at work here with this supremacist doctrine and what makes it so worrying and what makes the work that you've been doing so important in trying to, clarify and call to arms, in effect, those of us who are not yet perhaps in the crosshairs, but will be in due course. And this brings me to the events of this week, Pamela, and I wanted to get your thoughts on the most recent jihadist attack in our country, the implications not only of this particular individual and his personal history, but as a sort of symptom of a much larger problem, particularly with respect to the infrastructure that inculcates and breeds and fosters jihadism inside this country.
Listen, it's absolutely predictable. I warned in my 2010 post-American presidency, the Obama administration's war in America, about diversity visas. I've been writing about them since 2009. This was going to happen. It was just a question of when. I want to make one note on something you said regarding the Sharia supremacism. If you recall, when the Salman Rushdie fatwa was issued, the world was galvanized behind him. Margaret Thatcher invited him to the 10 Downing, even though they were political adversaries and he was a vocal critic of Prime Minister Thatcher. But everyone understood and everyone stood behind Salman Rushdie. And now you fast forward 10 or 20 years and you see just how far the Sharia supremacists have advanced. To me, it's extraordinary, the response comparing Rushdie to now.
No, it's a very important insight, Pamela. And one other piece of this, which is also, of course, as you know so well, at work, is in addition to being intimidated or in a way suborned, we have an awful lot of other folks who are simply willfully blind to the problem, and that includes people in government. I know you've butted heads with the mayor of New York City, Mayor de Blasio, with some regularity. He was, of course, one of the first to describe this as an act of terrorism. But is it not the case, Pamela Geller, that he has helped dismantle the New York Police Department in some of the most important efforts it had been making to try to understand, have situational awareness of this threat and counteract it?
Bingo. Look, before he was elected, I ran ads pointing out that he meant to dismantle counterterrorism initiatives, that he would hurt our national security initiatives here in the city. And the fact is that mosque, the Masjid Omar of the New York terrorist, was under investigation. That mosque was under investigation, and it was Mayor de Blasio who dismantled that program. They were investigating. There were 20. They had over 20 they called radicalized, I may call devout, but let's not get into semantics, that they were deeply, deeply concerned with. Now, who's to say if they continued investigating this mosque that they could have thwarted this plot? And Mayor de Blasio is up for re-election next week. And I will tell you that in all likelihood, he will be re-elected. He is your worst nightmare. And you would think in this age that such things would be impossible, but they are very possible and they are very everyday because the people have been disarmed in the information battle space.
Right. Let me make two quick points, Pamela. One, first of all, you're so right. And this is a tipping point, and especially so because, as you know better than just about anybody, the enemy is emboldened when they see us doing this. They regard our political correctness or whatever we want to dress it up as submission, which simply is the red flag to the bull for more aggressive behavior. But Pamela, I wanted to just close with a quick question to you about the pressure that you are under, not just from the jihadis, the fatwa-wielding murderers, but from the left, who seek to silence you as well. Would you talk a little bit about, well, what amounts to kind of a red-green axis, a pincer movement, if you will, that is a threat not just, as you say, to you, but really to all of us?
This is exactly, you nailed it. It's the Red-Green Alliance. It's the leftist Islamic alliance, and the jihadists and the Sharia supremacists could never have advanced as far as they have without their useful idiots on the left. And they are enormously powerful. Media, music, movies, academia, public schools. What they do is they won't engage with me in the information battle space. They won't debate me because I'll win. I will win because my ideas of individual rights and of equality for all before the law are better. And their ideas cannot stand up to scrutiny. Their ideas cannot stand up to challenge. So what do? They have this enormous machine, and they demonize, marginalize, they monsterize you. All you have to do is Google my name, and you would think I have horns, and that not because I'm Jewish, okay? And they have been very effective because there's only been a handful of us. And you know, they've not only been effective, of course, in the cultural zeitgeist, but particularly with the rhinos, with the Republicans on our side, the spineless, gutless wonders, for example, at CPAC. And I don't have to tell you what has gone down. I was banned at CPAC. And, you know, I consider myself a conservative's conservative. So we have a big problem on our hands. And I tell you it's because people have been misinformed. Let's look at the response. 4 hours after the New York jihad attack, you have NBC with the headline, Muslim Americans Brace for Backlash. This is the same thing that went on 9/11. There have been 30,000 deadly Islamic attacks since 9/11. And what do we get after an attack? We get dawah. We get proselytizing. What does that do? First of all, it's just motive. It attacks the kuffar. It attacks the targets. And we get this over and over and over again, the dawah and the post-jihad attack. Now is the time for us to proselytize. It's incredible. Muslims brace for backlash. How about Muslims band together to demand that mosques institute programs that teach against the violent Quranic verses and teachings that incite to jihad?
Pamela, we have got to leave it at that. Thank you so much again for joining us and for introducing our audience to Fatwa Hunted in America. Very timely and important contribution to this information battle space. And I hope you'll come back to us again very soon with updates. In the meantime, stay safe, stay well. Next up, we will talk with Rosemary Jenks about immigration and more.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined by Rosemary Jenks. I believe she is one of the most knowledgeable and perspicacious and influential individuals in Washington, D.C. at the moment when it comes to matters involving immigration. So it is always a pleasure to catch up with her, but particularly at a time when suddenly something called the diversity lottery is much in the news and on people's minds. Rosemary Jenks, thank you so much for joining us from Numbers USA, where you are the Director of Government Relations and an indispensable ally in the fight for border security and sensible immigration policies in our country. Thanks again for joining us.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Frank.
So, diversity lottery, what on earth is that?
Yeah, that is a very good question. Can you imagine setting out an immigration policy that you believe would serve the national interest and deciding, well, one of the things we should definitely do is have a random drawing for visas, green cards, for people who maybe, you know, come from countries that haven't sent a lot of immigrants in the past. So we'll give them a new anchor in the United States, regardless of the fact that they have no ties here, no job here, no skills to offer that we need.
Or perhaps even that their government may be deeply hostile to our country, as in Iran, for example. I noticed the other day that there were 2,600 or so folks who have come in from Iran under this program. When this was adopted, surely there was some rhyme or reason to it back in 1990. Who was the principal author of it in Congress, and was there some express purpose given for doing this?
Well, this was the brainchild of Senator Ted Kennedy, and his actual purpose for doing it was to provide amnesty for illegal Irish immigrants who were already in the United States but had not been here long enough to qualify for the 1986 amnesty. So for the first 3 years of the lottery program, he set aside 10,000 visas each year specifically for illegal Irish. So that was his real purpose, but he had to give it a veneer of political correctness and make it a diversity visa so we could bring in other people from particularly terrorist sponsoring countries.
There's been reference made to Chuck Schumer's involvement in this, the now Senate Minority Leader. What was that, Rosemary? And did he have any better justification for doing this than Ted Kennedy?
He was actually on the House Judiciary Committee at the time, and he was the House sponsor of this bill that created the lottery. And he was very excited about this lottery. You know, there were a lot of illegal Irish in New York. And he also loves the idea of, you know, giving out as many green cards as possible so that, you know, we can replace the American people with some polyglot culture that we don't recognize.
And that would vote Democratic substantially, I think, was his expectation. And Rosemary Jenks, there is some description of this lottery that suggests that people who are going to be considered as entrants in what I actually think is not a game of chance, but Russian roulette for our country, that they would be actually vetted before they were allowed to participate in the lottery. Is that how this has worked in practice?
Well, no. And in fact, the General Accountability, our Government Accountability Office, actually did a report in the early 2000s that specifically said that the Visa lottery is a national security risk because it's the perfect way for foreign intelligence agents from countries like Iran to enter the United States. Because, of course, we can't vet people whose governments don't want to share information with us. And we've also had problems with, for example, they started at one point doing DNA testing because people were claiming children, minor children, on their lottery application who were not, in fact, their children. So they were, you know, going through the village and saying, hey, do you want to come to America with me? I'm applying for the lottery. And then we would have, you know, a couple with 11 children who were not theirs.
And then chain migration from there, too. These again, you're mentioning visas, but these are actually permanent visas. They get green cards. They get to stay in this country. They ultimately get to become citizens on the basis of no vetting to speak of and indeed a lot of fraud. There's a report out that Chuck Schumer tried to repeal this statute. Ann Coulter pointed out last night on Fox that, well, he did, but it was as part of a deal to get 35 million illegal aliens amnesty, the so-called Gang of Six, which you and Numbers USA fought very effectively. And thank you for that, Rosemary Jenks. Let me ask you, this is clearly a moment when we need competent people managing our immigration policies. Would you tell us whether, in your judgment, Kirstjen Nielsen, the woman who has been designated to be the next Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, has the requisite qualifications or is otherwise the right choice for such a job at such a time? Rosemary Jenks?
Well, I would start by saying, Frank, that I think we all know that immigration was at least one of the top three issues on which President Trump was elected. So the American people were clearly saying, we want Trump's immigration agenda. Well, Kirstjen Nielsen doesn't agree with Trump's immigration agenda. So that's one thing. She doesn't apparently support the building of the wall. But more importantly, there is no indication that she is qualified to run the largest federal department in the country. I mean, she apparently has managed as many as half a dozen staff, and now she's going in to manage over 200,000. She doesn't, in fact, meet the statutory qualifications for some of the subordinate offices that she would oversee, including, for example, the director of ICE has to have 5 years of law enforcement experience and 5 years of management. She would not qualify for that position, which would be subordinate to her as secretary.
Incredible. I don't understand how such a person has been selected for this post at such a momentous time. Rosemary Jenks, what's the backstory here? Where did she come from, and why would she be the choice?
Well, most recently, she was General Kelly's chief of staff at the Department of Homeland Security when he was secretary, and then she moved over to the White House with him. And she was put in charge of finding the new nominee, and apparently she didn't look very far because she found herself. So, you know, it's an interesting little twist there that she decided that she would be the right person.
It gives the term self-selecting a whole new meaning, doesn't it? Oh, Rosemary, and I understand she has a confirmation hearing coming up in the Senate Homeland Security Committee next week. Is that correct?
Yes, it's scheduled for November 8th. So we'll see what happens. I mean, it would behoove the entire country for those senators to actually really look at her qualifications and whether or not it appears that she can actually manage more than 200,000 people at the Department of Homeland Security.
The most dysfunctional government agency in the country, to say the least. This is a management challenge for even somebody who really knows their way around that sort of business.
Well, and it's not just immigration, though. It's also a branch of the military, the Coast Guard. It's the Secret Service. You know, there are all kinds of agencies in there. And where's her expertise?
Yeah, well, and there's also the whole question of, would she understand the nature of Sharia supremacism, which, of course, is how we started this conversation, is we have a problem with it, not just people coming into this country, but also people who adhere to that totalitarian doctrine who are already here. I don't know of any evidence that she actually gets that or would be a real help in contending with it. Rosemary, we have to leave it at that. I had wanted to talk to you about the amnesty bill that, speaking of amnesty, that apparently Paul Ryan intends to jam through the Congress, but we'll have to have you back quickly to do that, if we may, in the near future. Thank you so much for your time today. Come back to us again soon. Next up, Rick Manning joins us. We'll talk about the Uranium One scandal and more. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined by Richard Manning. He is the leader of an indispensable organization, Americans for Limited Government. He formerly served in the Department of Labor under the George W. Bush administration and also as a lobbyist for the National Rifle Association. He is very actively contributing to the public policy debate, among other things, through columns in places like The Hill and Investors Business Daily, FoxNews.com. He graces our program from time to time, for which we're always very grateful. This is one of those occasions. Rick, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Frank.
I wanted to explore with you, as a man who prides himself on helping improve the quality of government, to talk a bit about the history of the Clinton team, going back to Bill Clinton's time. When it comes to a certain willingness to betray the national interest in exchange for political or financial gain, would you remind us about Bill Clinton and the Chinese communists, some of his technology transfer initiatives, and then we'll talk about his wife and what she did during her time as the Secretary of State?
Well, when Bill Clinton was president, he was under investigation by a congressional committee led by Chris Cox, Representative Chris Cox, who later became the SEC chairman. Chris Cox was investigating a tie between an Indonesian financier who was pushing a lot of money into the Clinton machine and the technology transfer of a lot of our stealth technology that was being stolen right out of our national labs based in New Mexico.
Also, ballistic missile technology relevant to multiple independently targetable warheads, MIRVing.
Indeed. Things that you would never, ever, ever want to send to somebody who wanted to kill you. We were busily providing them with generational leaps in technology. In fact, one could argue today that the reason the Chinese have been able to bulk up their military so rapidly and so effectively is because they haven't had to figure out how to do it. And that's largely because Bill Clinton transferred the technology to them. That was the real scandal that they were investigating that would have impeached the president. And we got sidetracked with Monica Lewinsky in the and the whole investigation went away in terms of the real problem, which was the technology transfers to people who didn't like us very much.
So flash forward, Rick Manning, to Hillary Clinton's time as the Secretary of State. There's been a lot of talk along very similar lines about this this Uranium One transaction. Does this fit the pattern as you see it?
Well, I really do think it does. You know, we've got in Clinton Cash, the book Clinton Cash, it details how the Clinton Foundation received $145 million from the board of directors of the company that actually ended up being able to purchase Uranium One. We know that the Obama administration, we know that Bill Clinton gave a speech to that company and had got a $500,000 honorarium. His normal honorarium is $250,000. And in that speech, you even talked about Uranium One.
And of course, with this transaction went some 20% of America's uranium reserves to a country fully capable of using that uranium to build nuclear weapons to threaten this country. I mean, am I missing something here? This sounds like a betrayal of the first kind.
Yes, well, they were busy resetting the relationship. But part of it is even worse than the fact that it was transferred to a country that doesn't have our best interests at heart, and then the Democrats have suddenly discovered they don't like. The real amazing part of this is they put in all this language that said the uranium could never leave certain and had to be counted for. Well, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission came out last week and said they don't know where some of the uranium is.
Well, and some of it went to Canada. We know that for sure. So it's not here. That's for sure.
And it's not here. And I've heard two different credible sources who have a reason to know say that they believe that it ended up in Iran. So and we're sitting here in a world where we're really struggling against the jihadists, the Islamic jihadists who are coming after us. And we see them on our streets just recently in a horrific attack. But we know that, you know, Obama did this horrific deal with Iran, which really accelerated their capacity and legitimized their capacity to get nuclear weapons. And now the Uranium One deal may in fact be providing them with a very necessary ingredient to proceed with that process. It's unbelievable that we've done this, and they did it for money.
Yeah, and you know, Rick, it is so striking that this is the country that they were doing business with, the Russian government, Vladimir Putin specifically, is the same outfit that the Democrats are so vehemently protesting is an enemy nation of ours. It couldn't be more bizarre, notwithstanding the fact that they were busily trying to suck up to the Russians in this so-called reset phase. They were hostile to us at the time. They are hostile to us now, the Putin team, and they will be for the foreseeable future, as are the Iranians and so on. Hey, listen, very quickly, Rick, on this point, we do have a critical test here for the rule of government, it seems to me, because if what you've said is true, and I believe it is, that there's been, at the very best, malfeasance on the part of the Clinton team, and more likely, the betrayal of our country in the service of people who would enrich them, but who are hostile to us. Rod Rosenstein is one of the key players in this drama, now the Deputy Attorney General of the United States, because Jeff Sessions recused himself from an investigation of these charges that Trump was colluding with the Russians. He has a rather problematic role in this Clinton scandal, and I would like you to connect those dots, if you would, and tell us whether he can possibly continue to serve, given the compromising of his role and status, it seems to me.
Well, it's Frank, your listeners will appreciate this as the ultimate swamp story, because Rod Rosenstein was the prosecutor, the U.S. attorney prosecuting the company that ended up buying Uranium One. They were prosecuting him for bribery, and they were looking at and they were investigating from bribery. Rod Rosenstein was the U.S. attorney from Maryland who was responsible for that prosecution. The FBI director at the time, who was responsible for the investigation, was Robert Mueller. And so you have, and somehow that investigation, which started in 2009, at the same time that company was trying to buy Uranium One, they said, we don't really care if they're being investigated for this, which should have made them ineligible under the law. Instead, they pushed the investigation back, and they didn't actually come to get any charges until 5 years later. And there were minor charges that a couple of people were rung up on.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the horse is squarely out of the barn in terms of this Uranium One deal.
You have to expect that the Department of Justice, Eric Holder at the time, knew that the company that was trying to buy Uranium One was in fact being investigated for bribery. They had somebody embedded into the company, the parent company, who is now coming out as a whistleblower, who's going to provide a lot of information. We don't know what it is, so it's hard to say up front what we're going to see. But he's got a lot of documents, a lot of information that he believes will implicate a lot of people involved in what would be a cover-up of the actual investigation to allow the Uranium One transfer to happen.
It's scandalous in the extreme. Rick Manning, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Particularly, I'm anxious to talk with you further about the role that the so-called Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States played in allowing that transaction to go forward, when at least one of the principals on that committee, the Attorney General of the United States at the time, Eric Holder, knew all about, we have to believe, this investigation of bribery and kickbacks and corruption associated with this particular transaction. A scandal of the first order. We appreciate tremendously the work you do exposing and holding people accountable for this sort of misconduct at Americans for Limited Government. Rick Manning, keep it up, my friend, and come back to us again, if you would, very soon. Next up, Fred Fleitz will join us. We'll talk about this kind of scandal and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Fred Fleitz is in the house, virtually at least, I'm very pleased to say, our senior vice president at the Center for Security Policy for Policy and Programs, a career intelligence professional who brings incredible expertise to bear on the various public policy issues, particularly in the national security space of our time, thanks to his some 20 years in the Central Intelligence Agency as an analyst and his service as the chief of staff to then Undersecretary of State John Bolton, as well as his service on the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence under its then chairman, Pete Hoekstra. He's a go-to guy on so many issues, including the ones that we want to talk with him about, notably the state of American intelligence and law enforcement. And Fred, for all that, thank you so much for joining us. Good to have you back.
Good to be here, Frank.
So we were talking earlier in the program with Pamela Geller about this attack in New York. I did want to get your thoughts on it as well, but particularly, Fred, the extent to which it seems yet again our intelligence services, our law enforcement community is not doing what we need them to do to anticipate these threats based upon the kinds of evidence that Sharia supremacism is on the march in mosques and Muslim communities across this country, to say nothing of people who are being brought in by diversity lotteries and the like. What are your thoughts on all of that?
Well, let's start by talking about what New York officials said about this attack. They immediately said, well, there's no evidence of foreign links, that the terrorist was self-radicalized recently in this country. Frankly, nobody knows that yet. These people should be saying those things. But we always see these attacks being downplayed by officials who do not want to admit a link to the global jihad movement and ISIS. What we do know is that this terrorist suspect was interviewed in a counterterrorism case just 2 years ago. We also know that his mosque in New Jersey was being monitored by the New York police. There was an agreement between New York police and a former New Jersey governor allowing them to monitor mosques in New Jersey under certain circumstances. But that program was shut down by Mayor de Blasio because he thought it was not sensitive to Muslims. So I'm wondering, there seems like there's a lot of dots here that weren't connected. And I'm wondering whether some of them weren't connected because of political correctness and because of officials like de Blasio who are in denial about this threat.
I wonder about that, too. I also wonder, Fred Fleitz, whether in particular this problem of the enemy within is now being so massively misunderstood or underestimated, at least, that when we see indications like those you've mentioned, it's not properly perceived as an incipient threat. Not only are we, you know, reluctant to say such a thing, but even thinking about it, let alone acting on the basis of such prudential judgment, is now, it seems, impossible, even under the Trump administration. Could that be?
I'm afraid that that's the case. The Obama administration, the mainstream media did a lot of damage to make it politically incorrect, and people are afraid to say something when they see something. And here's a good example. Barack Obama sent a tweet after the attack in New York, the terrorist attack in New York. And he said, Michelle and I sent our condolences over the New York attack. Well, my friend Sebastian Gorka sent a note saying, what kind of attack, Mr. President? I mean, after 8 years of controversy over Obama failing to use the word radical Islamic terrorism or to admit that there is a global jihad movement, he still can't bring himself to use these words or to characterize an act of jihadist terror for what it really is.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to say that true as that is, as far as I can tell, nobody in the Trump administration used that term either, Fred. So this is what's worrying to me is I think the American people voted for a course correction from the kinds of misbegotten policies that you've described that were being pursued by the Obama administration for 8 years, come what may, including embracing the Muslim Brotherhood outright. And unfortunately, there hasn't been as much of a change on the part of the Trump administration as one would have expected, and certainly as we need.
I think the president gets it, but he's surrounded by advisors who are thinking exactly what you just said. That's why we need a house cleaning. That's why H.R. McMaster has to go.
Well, I couldn't agree more on that. Fred, let me ask you about Vladimir Putin. He is apparently in Iran, a country that you're monitoring very closely. There is a report in the Washington Free Beacon by a friend, Adam Credo, that Russia has begun construction on a new Iranian nuclear plant. Very, very concerned that what we're watching play out before our eyes is not only the kind of collaboration between the Russians and the Iranians that has helped the two of them establish essentially themselves as the rulers effectively of Syria, for example, and now increasingly, you know, sort of hegemonic factors in the Middle East, but is contributing very materially to the nuclear weapons threat we're facing from the Iranians as well.
Well, the Russians rushed in to fill a power vacuum that stretched from Iran to Syria because of Barack Obama's leading from behind and his refusal to recognize the threat from the global jihad movement that Iran represented. He desperately wanted a legacy nuclear deal, and he was prepared to give away anything to get it. We've known for some time that Russia was planning on building several nuclear reactors, light water reactors, in Iran. And this article in the Washington Free Beacon sort of confirms that it looks like the first reactor, if construction hasn't started, it'll start soon.
So, Fred, with all of those interests, it seems unlikely that the Russians will be any more supportive than the Iranians have been so far of this effort to, as they call it, fix the Iran deal, which you have properly in your book, Obama Bomb, a Dangerous and Growing National Security Fraud, warned of about. If that's the case, is this notion that there will be fixing the deal to improve its verification regimen or dispense with the sunset provisions, is that really just a snare and delusion, Fred?
It really is. You know, there's some of our conservative fellow travelers, I think they're conservatives, who deluded themselves into thinking we can fix the deal. And I've talked to some people on the Hill and with some Republicans. They think that we can fix verification, we can fix the sunset provisions, that's how long the deal lasts. And as naive as that is, they're ignoring the fact that this deal has far more serious problems. It lets Iran to continue to enrich uranium. It allows Iran to continue to produce plutonium. Until those two points are fixed, there's no point in trying to fix the other aspects. This deal is not going to be fixed. It's a fantasy. And it is my hope that the president will see that, and he'll give Congress a couple of months, and then he will kill this terrible deal.
Well, we need him to, for sure. Fred Fleiss, lastly, very quickly, there have been an enormous number of documents that have been released from the trove of information that was scarfed up when Osama bin Laden was killed by our SEAL team. What do we know about what's in those documents, and what does it tell us about the state of al-Qaeda?
Well, I think what's most interesting about them is that it gives a considerable amount of detail on the amount of cooperation between Al-Qaeda and Iran, which people on the left said didn't exist because Sunnis and Shiites don't cooperate. Now, we've known for some time that they were cooperating. But what I think we're finding out here is that the Obama administration hid this material because they thought it would interfere with their efforts to get congressional support for this terrible Iran deal.
Yeah, another cynical gambit, unfortunately all too successful, to snooker the American people and their elected representatives in Congress on this terrible and very dangerous national security fraud, as you called it in your book, Obama Bomb. Fred Flights, as always, thank you so much for joining us and the great work you do at the Center for Security Policy. Come back to us again next week. I hope the rest of you will do the same. Again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.